I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 13th, 2017. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes, and Senator Wilikowski, as well as myself, Senator Giesel. Thank you to Ann and Matt, who are keeping the records and keeping the audio going for us. So today we're taking up two items on the agenda. First, we're going to take up Senate Bill 6, presented by Senator Hughes, and then we'll have an overview of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. So, on our first item, Senate Bill 6 by Senator Hughes, it relates to the use of industrial hemp in Alaska. The bill was first heard last week on February 8th. At that meeting, the sponsor, Senator Hughes, and her staff, Buddy Witt, pointed out that the bill would need some changes in order to more formally comply with the recent changes in federal law. Before this committee is a proposed committee substitute. This document and additional material was distributed to committee members, agency personnel, and made publicly available on February 9th. Senator Coghill, may I have a motion to adopt the committee substitute as the working document?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the CS for Senate Bill number 6 as our working document. That's 30-LS-0173 uniform, dated 2-7-17.
Thank you, and I'll object for purposes of explanation and discussion. I ask my committee staff, Ike Geolopsis, to come forward, as well as Buddy Witt, the sponsor staff, to explain the changes.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Ike Geolopsis. I'm staff to Senator Giesel and to the Senate Resources Committee.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Buddy Witt, legislative aide to Senator Shelley Hughes.
Madam Chair, this is Ike Geolopsis. With the committee's indulgence, I will review the document for the committee entitled Explanation of Changes in Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 6, Version Uniform. And these changes will be from Version Uniform and contrasting it to the original committee document, Version Alpha. The first change, Madam Chair, is to be found in the title, which is page 1, lines 1 through 4. And this revises the title of the bill to more clearly define the intent and the subject matter that was referenced in the previous hearing. And that includes adding in the titles for the appropriate sections that are discussed by Mr. Witt, particularly those related to the establishment of pilot programs, separating the definition and change in the statutes for industrial hemp from marijuana, and also clarifying that industrial hemp to food does not adulterate that food. The second change is still on page 1, and that can be found from line 6 through the end of page 1, line 14, and continues through the entirety of the second page. And that adds industrial hemp as an agricultural product to Title 3. It also establishes the Division of Agriculture within the Department of Natural Resources as the regulatory authority for industrial hemp. And it also lays out minimum registration guidelines and establishes guidelines for seed, plant, and record retention by the registered growers. The third change, Madam Chair, is to be found on page 3, lines 1 through lines 8, and that adds language establishing industrial hemp growth as a pilot program that only those who have registered at an institution of higher learning may participate in, so in reference to the federal statutes that Mr. Witt had referenced in the February 8th hearing. And this additional language is added in order to be in line with Section 7606 of the Agricultural Act of 2014. Turning to the second page of the explanation of changes, the next change on Version Uniform can be found on page 3, lines 9 through lines 11, and that places the definition of industrial hemp under Title 3 instead of under Title 11 as it was in Version Alpha. And the definition itself is unchanged and matches the definition in the 2014 Agricultural Act. The next change can also be found on page 3 of the bill, lines 12 through line 21, and the language there that's added to the bill specifies that under Alaska Statute 1171-900, industrial hemp is not marijuana, thereby removing industrial hemp from the list of controlled substances. The next change is also on page 3, lines 22 through 24, and that adds language to exclude food containing industrial hemp from adulterated foods found under Title 17 of Alaska statutes. And Madam Chair, the final explanation for changes for Version Uniform can be found on page 3, lines 25 through 31, and on page 4, lines 1 and 2. And I apologize to committee members. An earlier explanation of changes had said that page 3, lines 25 through 30 what is the extent of the changes? I forgot a line. So that has been updated, and that's in your committee packets, and that's also on basis. That change specifically puts language in to further exclude industrial hemp from marijuana definitions under Title 17. So that's the list of the changes in this proposed committee substitute, Madam Chair, and Mr. Witt is available for questions, as is Mr. Carpenter, the Director of the Division of Agriculture, who's online.
Thank you. It is true that Rob Carter is, it says Rob Carter, thank you, Division of Agriculture is online, as well as Arthur Keyes. So, Mr. Witt, any further comments about the changes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to your staff, Ike, for his help in this. Just for the for the committee, just a short review. If you recall, last Wednesday in this meeting, when the first version of the bill was introduced, we talked specifically about the federal laws, what changes need to be made in order to comply with federal law, and I believe we've addressed those matters with this CS. Happy to answer any questions that you have in particular.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. This is a pretty dramatic change from the first version, and I understand we're concerned about complying with federal law, but we don't comply with federal law on marijuana, so why are we worried about doing it regarding hemp?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would just say that there is a federal law. It is pretty clear what actually has to be in statute in order to comply with the federal law, and that is the blueprint that we followed in order to develop this piece of legislation. I can't really speak for other statutes regarding other plants or what comes for those plants, but as far as industrial hemp is concerned, we've tried to draft a piece of legislation that could give us our very best chance of being successful as well as complying with federal statutes that we know.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
I get why you're doing it. It's pretty onerous when I look at it. It's requiring that individuals register. It's requiring that they list their global positioning coordinates where they're going to be producing the hemp. They've got to register every year. They've got to pay fees for applications, and the fees have to cover the cost, the regulatory cost. So that could be, you could kill this entire industry, or if somebody wanted to, who's in charge, they could kill this entire industry by setting the costs so high that it would simply drive these small businesses out of business. It requires that they keep records for 3 years wherever they transfer the hemp from. And two, this is big government. I mean, this is extremely onerous as I look at it. Do we have any idea what the costs would be? Do we have any sense from the Department of Agriculture?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, in our discussions with the Division of Agriculture, Mr. Carter, who is on the line, can probably answer this much better than I could. But if I can go back to the beginning portion of your statement, I will say for the record that a lot of the information that is within this CS and the reason it was put together has a lot to do, and for your reference, and I'm happy to give a copy of this document to the committee, but it comes from the Federal Register, Volume 81, Number 156, which was produced on August 12, 2016, from the Department of Agriculture, which specifically laid out the items that any state division of agriculture or Department of Agriculture would have to do in order to be, in their view, to be in compliance with the federal law. And while it's not for me to judge how onerous the legislation is or how big it could be, it is very clear that the Division of Agriculture would have to be the regulatory authority and would have to have the powers to set those regulations in order to keep tabs on this new growth industry. As to the second part of your question, I'll defer to Mr. Carter, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Mr. Carter, can you hear us? And did you hear Senator Wilkowski's question?
Through the chair, Senator, yes, ma'am, I can hear you.
Great.
If you
would
hear me okay?
Yes, if you would just introduce yourself for the record and then give us your answer.
For the record, my name is Rob Carter. I work for the Division of Ag, and I am the manager of the Alaska Plant Material Center. For the question regarding fees for this industry and how onerous this bill is, I actually really support this bill professionally because I think that by sticking to the guidelines that have been laid out federally, it really provides the longevity and sustainability to a industrial hemp industry in the state of Alaska. According to our fees and how we may out-fee or out-regulate this industry, that is by no means the intent of the division. You know, across the country, nationwide, I would say that, you know, fees, annual fees are anywhere between $25 per annual application and upwards of $500. For the division itself, we really plan on making this registration a pretty simple process and application that's given by industry to us so that we can maintain the knowledge of where it is, and more or less that's for consumer protection and protection of the farmers, so that when someone drives by and sees an industrial hemp field and claims that it's a recreational or medical marijuana grow and they call a law enforcement official, they can then have access to call us and say, hey, is there a location in the Delta region off this road that is has an application or is registered for growing industrial hemp, to help reduce some of that overhead for those individuals on that. I believe personally that I think that the division can maintain and take on this workload with any additional money at this time. We really can't say what the fee is going to be. I would say that it'll be somewhere between $25 and $50, just like grass and grain inspection or certification process, very similar to our potato process. But without knowing how many individuals are going to actually partake and become an industrial hemp producer, but our goal is to educate before we regulate these folks and make sure that we can have a sustainable industrial hemp industry.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Do you anticipate any new hires as a result of this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, no, we don't. We plan on taking this additional workload on with current staff. We'll build an online application as well as a printable that can be sent to the division with their payment. We'll then, for the first year, build ourselves a database so we have record, and then evaluate it on a year-by-year basis. You know, we really want to see this industry take off. We think that this industry has an opportunity to do something here in Alaska for the in-state market as well as for potential for export. And there's a few things in federal regulation that have allowed that opportunity for hemp products, industrial hemp products, to be exported to other states and to worldwide. So really for us, we're just going to take on this initial work, provide a registration process, build a database, and then grow with the industry.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
What is the penalty for noncompliance for a person who does not register or does not pay the fee or does not keep the appropriate records? Is that criminal or is it?
Senator Wilikowski, at this current time, if you can see in, sorry, let me pull the bill here, Section 1, F, the department may issue a stop sale order or issue a violation notice to a person who is producing industrial hemp without current registration. That is currently how the division responds to certified potatoes, certified grass and grain. People that are falling outside of things that we have authority for, we issue a stop sale. That is no penalty for that if you comply with that order, because that is a direct order. Under that authority, if someone does not, it is a civil penalty of a class. I think I can't quote me through Alaska Statute 03, I can't remember, I'm sorry, of a Class B misdemeanor and a $500 fine.
Senator Wilikowski.
And then in Section L, where it says the registrant shall maintain for at least 3 years following the sale or transfer of industrial hemp records. So if a person grows hemp and then they sell it or transfer their hemp to somebody else, they keep a record of that. What if the person who receives it then transfers it or sells it? Are they allowed to do that, or do they need to keep records as well?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, at this time, the way it is we're just looking for that initial transaction. We want to make sure traditionally when an agricultural crop is grown, produced, and harvested, it then makes one transition if it's leaving off the farm to go to a post-harvest processor. And that's where we really want to make sure we know where it is. Normally a product, an agricultural product, by the time it's made it through multiple hands and transitions there, it's been processed to a point that it would no longer really be an agricultural product. It's a post-harvest process product.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. How do these requirements compare to the requirements that we put on people who grow marijuana? Are they required to register and have a GPS system and keep track of all the transfers of where they sell their marijuana products?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I can only speak to that as much as I've paid attention to what the regulations are. Theirs are very burdensome from an agricultural production standpoint. Highly fees, regulated, both within their municipality or borough, they have to have approval. For us, I think this is a very simplified process. Even statewide around the nation, I think this is pretty standardized for the introduction of an industrial hemp production.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
And if somebody wants to grow some in their backyard, would they be able to do that under this legislation if they wanted to grow hemp in their backyard?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, they could very easily apply for apply an application, grow some hemp for personal use or anything else.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I agree with Senator Wilikowski. I think this is an industry that's got potential, and as we heard, it has a lot of good constructive uses for hemp. But I too wonder if this can all be done with a zero fiscal note, because it does seem like even the pilot program itself would cost something, and you don't know how many hemp producers there's going to be. So let me ask you, first of all, what will the fee structure look like? Is it by application, or is it based on the quantity produced?
Senator Meyer, through the chair, if I may, for the record, this is Buddy Witt, legislative aide to Senator Shelley Hughes. I would first like to say, and then I'll ask Mr. Carter to step in, that as the regulatory authority of the program, the Division of Agriculture will be able to decide how many registrants for this program they can take at a zero fiscal note if they choose to go that way. So if they can handle 15 at the beginning, just to see how this pilot program progresses without incurring any costs, then I imagine that this is based purely on my discussions with them. I don't have anything in writing, but I would imagine that they would take the number that they could without any additional costs. And then in the future, there is language that says they shall. I would say that the shall, when they say they shall be able to charge a registration fee, the fee could be zero. But they could go up from there. In the future, should this be a growth industry and they decide that the management of it requires them to incur more costs than they can handle internally. With that, Madam Chair, I'll hand over to Mr. Carter if you'd like to add to that.
Yes, Mr. Carter, do you want to add anything?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator, I know it seems very unique for a state agency to say they can do something without a fiscal note. And for me being here 5 years, I think if you look at what the division does, what the Plant Material Center does, working with agricultural industries of all types, from fruit trees to potatoes to grass and grain, for brewing and distilling industry. These are things that we take on because of our mission. Our mission is to support and encourage agricultural development in the state of Alaska. I think that in the initial steps with this bill passing, with the legalization of industrial hemp, with us wanting to see this agricultural industry grow, we can take on the ability of a registration process with some work, with current staffing. If this becomes the next biggest thing out of Alaska, is that going to be true? It may not be years from now. But to hobble the industry with high fees and lots of regulation is definitely not the way to get something up and growing.
Follow up, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And then one other, I think you made a comment, Mr. Carter, that this product could be exported, I don't know if you said worldwide, but certainly in the lower 48. And I'm wondering if our federal regulations allow that currently.
Yes, Senator. Actually, the 2014 Farm Bill within Section 7606 allowed the production and the trial by state agricultural agencies and universities. But then there's a really little known kind of slip through in the recent times within the Omnibus Appropriations Act of 2016, passed on December 18th of 2015 in Section 736, I believe, that states that, and I guess a little history before that, the Farm Bill legalized the production, but the biggest difficulty is what do you do with the product that you produce? The Farm Bill didn't authorize the interstate travel of industrial hemp products. And within this key provision in the Omnibus Appropriations Act of 2016, it said that no federal dollars no funds made available by that act or any other act may be used to prohibit or transfer processing sale of industrial hemp that is grown or cultivated in accordance with 7606 of the Agricultural Act of 2014 within or outside the state in which the industrial hemp is grown. So without the federal government really stepping in and saying industrial hemp can be grown, it can be juiced, it can be processed, and it can be shipped interstate, this really provides legal protections by proxy for allowing us to, because of that language and not allowing the feds to prosecute or use any funds to prosecute the production, the processing, or the sales of industrial hemp products. And that's really how the other states, Kentucky and Colorado and Maine and Vermont and Idaho, have been utilizing interstate commerce of their industrial hemp products.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. One more question?
Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the industrial hemp producers are required to have their hemp tested for THC content. And if that's true, which I think it is, where's this testing to be done? I think there's only two testing centers in Alaska currently.
Through the Chair, Senator, that is correct. The one good leaps and bounds for the industrial hemp industry is that the recreational marijuana industry paved the way for testing. So for a nominal fee through one of these private agencies, any individual that is growing a cannabis sativa plant can have a product tested for multiple cannabinoids, including THC, CBA, CBD, and CBNs.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I may?
Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
So a question I have, too, is could our state crime lab be used for testing as well if these other two are busy with the recreational hemp?
Through the Chair, to my knowledge, they have the equipment, a mass spec and a gas chromatographer that could do the work. I don't know. I can't speak to their workload. I can't speak to the availability of their employees. But on a scientific level, I believe that they do have the equipment to do that testing.
Follow-up, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I said one more last time, but I'm just wondering, will the university be involved, or could they be involved? Could they assist in this new potential agricultural industry that is being proposed?
Through the Chair, Senator, to my knowledge, I believe that the 2014 Farm Bill does allow them to take part in that. There has been in the past, I would say, and again, not speaking to what their plans and practices are, there has been some universities, co-workers that I've known for years, that have steered clear of anything with cannabis due to the amount of federal funding that they do get. So it's kind of the cart before the horse. They say it's legal, but they don't. But because they receive so many federal funds, they're not willing to jeopardize those federal funds to help one industry. Again, not being able to speak to what their motives are, what their practices are, and not having any contact about industrial hemp, but they very well could help and assist in this growing industry.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions, Senator Wilikowski?
On the fee issue, my concern is, just seeing how these things tend to go, there's probably a pretty good likelihood that somewhere down the road you'll need at least one person to regulate the industry. And if that person is making $100,000 a year and you've got 10 hemp producers, you all of a sudden go from $25 to $500 to $10,000 a piece. So I wonder if you'd be willing to add a section in here capping the amount of fees that could be charged to a farm or an individual at $500, so we can protect against overcharges and growing government, for that matter.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, for the record, this is Buddy Witt, legislative aide to Senator Shelley Hughes. That has been, quite honestly, a topic of conversation, and I think that is a great place for us to have a discussion in the next committee of referral with Judiciary, lining out exactly what those fees should look like, and I look forward to working with the Division Ag, along with Senator Hughes, to define what that should be.
Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Coghill.
Oh, and following the federal rules, and this may be for the sponsor, is there ag loans that that people would be eligible for based on federal revolving loan funds or state revolving loan funds? I know that agricultural bill went through, and I know that there was some potential for that. And so I think people of Alaska might want to know if they're going to start up a hemp farm that they are might be included in what the wheat and barley potentials are. So I don't know the answer to that. That's a question that many people will be looking for.
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I think that's an excellent question, and I can look into that for you. Perhaps Mr. Carter might have information of that, being an agronomist.
Mr. Carter, comments?
Through the chair, Senator, at this time, there are no limitations on the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund that's administered through the Division of Ag. It is administered by the Board of Agriculture and Conservation. We have not seen, to my knowledge, we have not seen a cannabis application submitted. But there is no regulation there stating that they cannot apply for a low-interest loan through a very well-managed fund to have an opportunity to grow their business.
Thank you. And Mr. Keyes, you're also online. Did you have further comment about that?
I do not. Chair Giesel, I do not have any more comments. I think Rob Carter has pretty much said what needs to be said.
Thank you, Mr. Keyes. Follow up, Senator Coghill.
And this is just a comment, and it goes to Senator Wilikowski's question, because I actually had the same question. I was thinking, if we don't follow those rules, does it preclude them from entering into any agreements? And that's kind of where I was headed with that question. Or if we do follow this template, does that give us an all clear to do that? So access to revolving loan funds would be the next big question, in my view.
Good question. Further questions? For the bill sponsor or any of the Division of Agriculture folks online? Yes, Senator Hughes.
May I make a comment from the table here, Madam
yes.
Chair? I just want to make it clear, of course, I'm all about simple, and if it weren't for some of the federal requirements, we would not have made the changes that we did, as Buddy indicated. A state is required to have a database, and that's we tried to keep it as simple, and I am grateful to Division Director Keyes and Rob Carter for working with us to try to keep it as simple as possible. Pretty easy now to get coordinates with even smartphones and to put it in the application. And the section on charging fees, I just want to point out that is a may. It's not a shall. And that is something that could be put in later if we felt uncomfortable with that being in now, or we could put a limit, as was discussed. I'm open to either. I just want, as I said in my opening remarks last week, I just want to make sure we give farmers one more economic opportunity. So whatever we need to make this work, I don't want to see it onerous for farmers. I want to see them successful. I don't want to see it high cost. I think it's going to be pretty simple. And if there were 10 farmers or 20 farmers, I don't think it would take, as simple as it's going to be, a whole division of agriculture employee. I mean, we'd have to get up to some pretty serious numbers of growers. And the other thing that's quite reassuring, too, is Rob Carter explaining that the way it would be planted as far as the distance and the rows and the plants, we're going to be pretty sure when we see a field that it is actually hemp. So that was quite a relief of a burden as far as overseeing the growth industry of hemp. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, it is my intention to remove my objection and hold the bill to allow fiscal notes to be drafted, updated, for the next hearing on Wednesday. So with that, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to adopting the committee substitute as the working document? Seeing none, the committee substitute is adopted. Public testimony was left open at the last hearing on February 8th, so members of the public will be able to call in to testify at the next scheduled hearing of the bill, which will be this coming Wednesday. So with that, we will set Senate Bill 6 aside and go to our next agenda item. Thank you very much, Mr. Witt, for presenting the bill. So, the next subject. Alaska is governed by acronyms. TAPS, ANCSA, ANILCA, NPRA, ANWR, BLM. The acronyms often result in a complex and heated discussion during our state's history. We're going to talk about one of those acronyms today, how it was created, when it was created, and hopefully build the public record recognizing its significance to our state and to our country. I'm speaking about the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, passed in 1980 in the last stages of President Jimmy Carter's administration. ANILCA was another and the last of the grand compromises of Alaska's entrance into the United States as a full-fledged member of the Union. If there was one word I would use to encapsulate the purpose of ANILCA, it was balance, a balance between conservation and development, national and state interest, rural and urban access to our land, streams, fish, and game. It was a carefully crafted law, and as its name suggests, embedded a promise. It was the national interest that the development of Alaska and the conservation efforts find an equilibrium. This committee will hear from the in-house expertise of the Department of Natural Resources as well as the Department of Fish and Game. One of the tenets of ANILCA was how our state agencies, constitutionally mandated to be stewards of our lands, fish, and wildlife for generations and for now and to come, were empowered to effectively use those management techniques. Over time, that intent has been tested and, some would argue, eroded. So I welcome Sue McGee from the Department of Natural Resources and Brad Palich from the Department of Fish and Game. Welcome. If you would identify yourselves for the record and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sue McGee. I'm the state's ANILCA program coordinator. I coordinate state agency reviews of federal actions that affect the conservation system units in Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brad Pollack with the Department of Fish and Game, and I'm the program manager for the ANILCA and Access Defense Programs, and I mirror Sue, but within the Department of Fish and Game.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. So I think we'll start with some background information, some context leading up to the passage of ANILCA. I don't think I need to tell everybody here that in 1958, the Alaska Statehood Act was passed, and it included a 103 million acre land grant to the state. In 1971, fast forwarding a little bit, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act established and granted surface and subsurface estate to Alaska Native Village and regional corporations. So in response to this massive transfer of lands out of federal ownership, there was a provision in ANCSA, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, excuse me for the acronyms, that called for a reservation of up to 80 million acres for study as future conservation areas in the state of Alaska. So this resulted in a very public and contentious debate among environmental groups, development proponents, the state of Alaska, rural residents of Alaska were concerned about this, obviously the state of Alaska. And during the 70s, there were several bills that were introduced that would propose various conservation designations in the state. One in particular was introduced in 1977. This is H.R. 39, and it was a game changer. It proposed 145 million acres of instant designated wilderness. And that shifted the discussion in Congress to look at special provisions for the state of Alaska that would accommodate our special circumstances. One of them being a new state that would be dependent on resource development. A lot of the state is very remote, and there were a lot of people living in areas that would be affected by these designations. So in 1978, a bill had not passed yet. So the D2 withdrawals were due to expire. So President Carter invoked the Antiquities Act to create 56 million acres of conservation areas, 17 individual national monuments. In response, Governor Hammond and the Alaska Legislature worked with a variety of constituent groups to identify seven consensus points that would be the state's formal position on resolving the lands issue. And I'm not sure. I think all of you were handed a copy of the actual resolution. These points were all addressed in the Act in one way or another. But I'll just go over quickly the seven points that the delegation carried forward. They wanted all of the 1978 monuments and executive withdrawals revoked. They wanted the state and the Native corporations to receive their full land entitlement. They wanted access across federal lands to state and private lands. They wanted to confirm state management of fish and game on all lands. They wanted to ensure that the conservation boundaries did not include economically important natural resources. They wanted to continue traditional land uses on all lands, and lastly, preclude administrative expansion of conservation system units. So, moving forward, in 1980, ANILCA was passed, and it's often referred to as the Great Compromise. And the Act itself has congressional intent that's stated very clearly in the beginning of the Act. Congress felt that they had balanced the national conservation interests with the social and economic needs of Alaska and its citizens. And the way they did that was they designated very large conservation system units of unprecedented size. The intent was to encompass whole ecosystems. And then, similarly, there were unprecedented provisions included in the Act for access and use. And so what it actually did was add over 100 million acres of conservation system units. It also redesignated some existing units. It resulted in 15 national parks, preserves, and national monuments that are managed by the National Park Service. There were 16 national wildlife refuges that are managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, 25 wild and scenic rivers, and 43 designated wilderness areas that are located within wildlife refuges, national parks, and national forests. It also added some other non-CSU areas, one national conservation area, a national recreation area, two wilderness study areas. One is the Nellie Juan College Fjord wilderness study area that's on the Chugach National Forest, and then there's the Central Arctic Management Area, which is up on the North Slope area. Here's a visual. I don't think you guys necessarily can see it, but there's a visual of all the conservation system units up on this on your slide.
Ms. McGee, just a question looking at the slide. So do other states have this degree of patchwork in terms of authority over different land pieces? Or are we unique?
Madam Chair, I'm sure there are states that have some conservation system units, but nothing that I believe equals what the state of Alaska has. It's pretty extensive. We're a big state, but these are also very large units that were designated. Thanks. So I'd like to go over some of the key ANILCA provisions that were very important to the state of Alaska. It is not a complete list by any means. We'd be here for a lot longer than we have time set aside for. But a lot of times you've probably heard of people refer to the No More Clause in ANILCA. There's actually several. The one that I referred to a couple slides ago is 101D. This is the statement that Congress made that they balanced the national conservation interests with the social and economic needs of Alaska. And basically, as a result, they felt like there's no need for any more conservation designations in Alaska. This is a really strong statement of intent, but it doesn't prohibit a future action of Congress. And that is reflected in a lot of the other No More Clauses. I think there's kind of a running debate right now as to whether some of the administrative actions that the federal agencies are taking, if those aren't shifting the balance, not in the state's interest. A second No More Clause is Section 1326A. This precludes the future large administrative withdrawals without congressional approval, which is something like the Antiquities Act, which is what President Carter used before ANILCA to withdraw the 56,000 acres, I think I said. So if a federal agency wants to withdraw more than 5,000 acres in the aggregate, they have to get congressional approval or the new FLIPMA withdrawal goes away. So that's how that one works. 1326B prohibits future studies of new conservation areas absent congressional direction. There's some language in this particular provision. It's referring to a single purpose study, and that's turned into somewhat of a loophole. So while we feel that that is a very clear statement in ANILCA, the federal agencies, some of them anyway, have been conducting wilderness and wild and scenic river studies in their management plan. So they feel like as long as they incorporate it into a management plan, it's no longer a single-purpose study. Then there's Section 7804, which prohibits further statewide roadless area reviews for the purpose of recommending additional designated wilderness, again, without congressional direction. The key word in this one is statewide, so it's really not very useful because you have two national forests in Alaska, and they could do them separately. And I know that the Department of Law is going to be here on Wednesday, and they're going to be talking about the roadless rule, so I think I'll defer to them on any further discussion on that one. Then we have several access provisions that apply. Section 1110A, this is for general public use. There's a general allowance for snow machines, motorboats, airplanes, and non-motorized methods of transportation for traditional activities. This applies to all the conservation system units, including designated wilderness and wild and scenic rivers. It's a very important provision for providing access to and within these areas that are, many of them are very remote and not on the road system. Then there's Section 811, which is a similar provision, but just for subsistence access. And this allows snow machines, motorboats, and other means of surface transportation traditionally employed. This other means of surface transportation for subsistence use typically is an all-terrain vehicle. Both 811 and 1110 are subject to reasonable regulation. So what does that mean? It means that the federal agencies can manage the use, and we don't dispute that. I think where we tend to have our disagreements is the justification for restriction or closure. The Park Service and Fish and Wildlife Service have regulations that are in place, that have been in place since the early 80s, and they require site-specific justification and a public process so that people that are affected by any restrictions or closures have a chance to communicate with the federal agencies and let them know how they're affected, and hopefully work with the federal agencies on maybe coming up with some other ways to address the resource concerns without restricting access. Then we have 1110B. That's inholder access, and that established a guaranteed right of access to state and private inholdings within conservation system units. Specifically, it's for adequate and feasible access for economic and other purposes. So if you have an inholding, you should be able to have a business on your inholding. You should be able to develop resources. It's a right of access. It's a really strong right of access. It's a really strong provision in ILCA, and it's very important. In response to then Governor Murkowski in the mid-2000s, we worked with the Park Service on getting some guidance in place to help inholders to secure their access, and where it was most important was in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park and Preserve, where there's a lot of inholdings. Let's see, Section 1323 is a similar provision to 1110B, but it applies to non-CSU, BLM, and Forest Service land, so it assures access. It's not as strong a right, but it's still very important, and I think probably Congress didn't anticipate problems with multiple use lands, which is what BLM and the Forest Service management is. And then another very important provision in Title 11 is these are Section 1101 through 1107. This is the transportation and utility system process in ANILCA. This is a process that ensures that federal agencies will consider a transportation or utility system project that occurs on a conservation system unit. So it doesn't guarantee an answer, but it ensures that they can't just turn a proponent away, or the state for that matter. There's a very strong statement of intent in this act that is very clear that Alaska is a young state and it needs to be able to develop its infrastructure. So that's why they developed a process so that that would could happen in the future. The process itself is a little out of date. The timelines are kind of out of sync with how long it takes to do an environmental document in today's world. But there's a a possibility for an extension, so people work with it. There's some other kind of procedural problems with it as well. And what I've heard is that industry just doesn't really think that this process works well. And I know it's been used for small projects, but I think when you get into a larger project, it's more problematic. And in all honesty, the federal agencies are in charge of the process. And so their first instinct is to protect and avoid a CSU. So that is generally the outcome. So I think the problem lies there. So I'm going to take a break and let Brad talk about some fish and wildlife provisions that are in Anoka, and then I'll return when he's done.
Before you do that, Ms.
Yes.
McGee,
yes.
Could I, you mentioned the Wrangell St. Elias during, I think you were talking about the 1110B section. Now, there's a management plan for that area. Is that plan complying, is it eroding our access through Anoka?
Madam Chair, the plan that the Park Service has for Wrangell St. Elias right now, it's still in the works, but it's a backcountry wilderness stewardship plan, and really it primarily deals with access. So I know inholder access is part of that list of provisions I just went through, but it's really more about the 1110A, which is public access, methods of access for traditional activities. I'm not sure that they're dealing with subsistence access. I think it's just primarily public access that's an issue in that plan.
But
snow machines in particular.
Sure, but nevertheless, I'm hearing some concerns that it's eroding access. Do
yes,
you agree?
Madam Chair, there are a lot of concerns, but it is the plan is pretty early in the early stages, and I think in response to comments they've received from the state as well as some other constituents and public, that they are rolling back some of those restrictions. Now, we haven't seen a new version of that yet, so I can't say for sure, but I think snow machines is still going to be an issue with that plan, so we're going to be watching it very closely.
Thanks. I think there's probably a couple other questions. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On that subject, so the departments track all these plans that the federal government puts forward is what I'm hearing you say, and then do you automatically respond to the statutory rights we have? And if they ignore them and, like, delete them, not even have them in a plan or recognize them, do you respond to them that we do have these rights and you want them included? Or how does the departments interact to ensure that we do have access and we do get our easements that we have, like, a statutory the rights to?
Senator, through Madam Chair, well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm the state coordinator. So when a federal agency releases a plan or a policy or regulation that affects one of these units, we review it. The state reviews it. And I work with any state agency that has an interest in what we're reviewing. So I would distribute it to all the agencies. And then we prepare written comments in response if it's a formal public comment period. But we also do try to talk and work with the agencies, the federal agencies, as the plans are being developed. There's provisions in ANILCA that require that they consult and cooperate with the state on different things, and planning is one of those areas where we are supposed to be working cooperatively. So yes, we do work with them. We also provide written comments and give them our perspective on whether or not they are in compliance with ANILCA.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Well, hey, Madam Chair, it just seems like sometimes they just ignore our statutory rights and make us basically extract them from them versus recognizing they exist, and particularly in the where I'm more familiar with the Tongass and what's going on up in the interior area. But it seems like the federal government doesn't go willingly.
Senator, through the chair, we have been struggling with this over the last few years. I think the state has always monitored the implementation of ANILCA very closely, but I think the last few years that we're a little frustrated, and they will go so far. I mean, they will recognize that 1110A applies to these units, but I think, as I mentioned earlier, where we often have disagreement is in the justification for a restriction or a closure. We don't necessarily agree that what they're using as justification is appropriate or warrants a closure. So we are on record that we don't agree with them. You know, if we have significant disagreements, sometimes, you know, we have legal challenges that result. But, yeah, we are working very hard to try and keep these provisions of ANILCA at the forefront and letting the agencies know when we don't feel that they're complying.
Senator Stidman, follow-up.
Just quickly on a follow-up. I think, you know, coming up, we're going to have some conversations on the roadless rule here, looking into that. And I think when that time comes here in a few days, it'd be nice for us to take a look at the road easements through the Tongass that was granted in TILU several years ago. And we have been having difficulty, I think, getting some of those cleared through. This was a transportation corridor system in Southeast. So that's was, you know, part of the background of the previous question. It just seems like it's they try to deal with us through regulation and ignore some of the statutory requirements when it's convenient for whatever direction they want to go.
Thank you, Senator Stidman. We'll be sure to bring that up when we talk with the Department of Law. Senator Coghill.
Thank you, and I was glad that you mentioned that that you tried to get in on the planning process. I know quite often they're ahead of you when that comes in. I think the disappointing thing to many of us is that they've invited non-government agencies in the planning process as way ahead of even the state, and yet ANILCA contemplated that the state would be at the table through the Land Use Planning Council. So I think we have a strong case to assert ourselves. So has there been some conversation within the state and the federal government about re-looking at a reconstituted Land Use Planning Council?
Senator, through the chair, I know there's strong interest in trying to reauthorize that. I don't speak for the state as to whether the state is supportive of that right now, but for those of us that work within this program, and you're ahead of me a little bit, I was going to talk about the Alaska Land Use Council and a couple of bullets here, but I think it would be helpful to have that forum to have more productive conversations.
Because I think, Madam Chair, for example, I'll just give you one, and I probably am jumping ahead of you. The up in my neck of the woods in the Eastern Planning Unit, it's environmental concern, areas of environmental, critical environmental concern, just drives me crazy. And no more clauses kind of in your face right now in both the Central and the Eastern Planning Units. And so we have to assert this law. As far as I know, this is a unique law between the federal government and the state among states. That is almost akin to the Louisiana Purchase Agreement, you know, and it should be held accordingly. And I think it's wrong for us to let the federal government overrule us. So I just think that this law becomes a tool that if we do not use it, then it looks to me like the federal agencies continually go to the Federal Land Policy Act instead of ANILCA. And it's up to us to reassert on every occasion. So anyway, I didn't want to push you any further, but I would like to light a fire under Alaska as much as I can, is all.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Mr. Pilech, if you'd like to go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Brad Pollock with the Department of Fish and Game. And when ANILCA was being discussed in Congress, management and use of fish and wildlife was a very significant topic for the issue, and ANILCA addressed it in several different places. Section 804 of ANILCA discussed establishing a priority for subsistence use of fish and wildlife over other uses when it was determined necessary to restrict a take of fish and wildlife. Section 1314 confirmed a very important part, which was that the state would retain management of fish and wildlife on all lands. Section 1316 considered existing uses on federal land, so they discussed an allowance for existing uses and future establishment of temporary facilities, campsites, tent platforms, shelters that were related to the take of fish and wildlife. Those are important not only for the general public, but for guided commercial use as well. We were just talking about state-federal cooperation, and Title 12 of ANILCA addressed the Alaska Land Use Council. And it was a joint federal, state, and Native corporation forum that was charged with making recommendations on ANILCA implementation, including required plans, studies, and regulations. So when say, the Fish and Wildlife Service did a comprehensive conservation plan or the National Park Service did a general management plan, the Land Use Council, which included the governor, the head of the federal agencies in Alaska, would meet, and they would consider those plans. They would discuss the pros and cons and how they thought it addressed ANILCA, and whether they thought that the plans were sufficient, or in some cases with the first round of National Park Service plans, whether they were deficient and needed to be redone, which did happen. The first round of general management plans for the National Park Service were returned and revised significantly over concerns that the Alaska Land Use Council provided. The council itself wasn't, it didn't go into perpetuity. It had a sunset, and the council recommended that there be congressional reauthorization of the Land Use Council, but that didn't go forward, and there was no legislation on the subject, and so the Land Use Council did go away. I can't remember the year, but so I guess it would have been 1990. Mm-hmm. Since it was 10 years into ANILCA. We have other ANILCA amendments that have passed since 1980. So ANILCA isn't a stagnant law. It does have some changes, and some of the examples are the Tongass Timber Reform Act, which in 1990 there was an amendment to it that eliminated the mandatory large timber sales and related subsidies, and it designated additional wilderness areas, and it designated 12 new land use designations, LUDs, LUD-2 on the Tongass National Forest, and then the Submerged Lands Act of 1988, it amended ANILCA Section 901 to exclude major waterways from ANCSA conveyances, which sped up Native corporation and state land conveyance processes. Basically what they did was if you were conveying land, you could come up to a major water body, and instead of having to try and figure out what to do with it, you could just exclude it. It didn't count against either the state or Native corporation in their land entitlements that the state got under the Statehood Act or under ANCSA. So. And back to Sue.
New slide. Oh, didn't go anywhere. Well, oh, no, this is correct. Sorry, I'm not looking at it correctly. We're good. So challenges, implementation challenges. I think as we mentioned, there are many provisions in ANILCA that require the federal agencies to consult or to coordinate with the state. And that's in addition to Title 12, which I find very interesting that you have an entire title of ANILCA devoted to federal-state cooperation. But that's not the only place where it says we're supposed to be talking to each other. I think what we're experiencing lately is that there are differing interpretations of what constitutes meaningful consultation and coordination. So there's a difference between informing somebody of what you're doing and having a good dialogue, exchange of information, and that's what we're looking for, is having that dialogue and an opportunity to share information and look for solutions. There's often more than one way to solve a problem. So that has been a challenge that we have been experiencing more and more over the past few years. Another issue is national policies and regulations get put into place that don't reflect or recognize ANILCA or Alaska's unique context. So the state frequently recommends regional guidance to local Alaska regional offices. And sometimes we're heard and sometimes we're not. We have some success stories in the past. The Forest Service in 2005 had a national access and travel management rule that went into effect, and it was inconsistent with ANILCA's open until closed provisions on access. And we finally got their attention. It took a little while, but then they agreed to do some regional guidance that allowed the district plans to be implemented in a manner that was consistent with ANILCA. So that was a success, and unfortunately, we have been talking to the Bureau of Land Management for a number of years now to put together some regional guidance for Alaska, because they're a multiple use agency and they don't have all of the same implementing regulations that the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service have that were promulgated in the early 80s. They do have some access, the Title 11 access regulations are Department of Interior, so they do apply to them. But they've introduced some new policies like the wildlands policy. I don't know if that rings a bell to everybody, but I think it was around 2010 that they introduced a new policy that required them to inventory their lands for wilderness character and then to manage to protect wilderness character. It wasn't a real designation by Congress, so a lot of states objected to this policy. And they made some changes. They don't actually designate what they call wildlands anymore, but they are still implementing the policy. And it's at odds with a lot of the access provisions and the special provisions in ANILCA that apply to designated wilderness. And so that's just an example. We would like for them to provide some regional guidance that would speak to all the staff that are working on the three plans that they're working on right now so that we don't have to continually, make the same comments over and over again. And unfortunately, we haven't made any progress there. At one point, they agreed to do it, but it was never a priority, so it's never happened. So what happens when these, federal decisions are inconsistent with ANILCA, it leads to unnecessary conflicts and, it's in some cases, litigation. If we can get this regional guidance into effect, it would help solve a lot of the conflicts that we currently have. Another challenge is what we're looking for when we're reviewing the plans, the policies, the regulations that are proposed. And so what the state is looking for, and keep in mind that we're looking at sometimes plans that are thousands of pages now. They're huge. But we're looking to protect public access for traditional activities, things like hunting, fishing, trapping, camping, things that we do in Alaska. We want to promote state-managed access to and along state waterways. We want to protect access and development opportunities for natural resources located on inholdings and adjacent non-federal lands. We want to encourage appropriate opportunities to provide tourism and visitor services that support recreational uses on the public lands and benefit the local economies that are affected by these areas. And we also want to ensure state management of fish and wildlife on all lands. So it's a challenging task that we do on a routine basis. But ANILCA often affects multiple state agency interests and mandates, and that's why we do the coordinated state agency review that I mentioned a couple of times. When we coordinate state agency comments on these federal actions, it allows the state to speak more powerfully with one voice. It also helps us to facilitate more effective consultation prior to the final decision. And as I mentioned before, that's kind of key, is getting in there before they've made their final decision. So that's an important aspect of our work. I guess the final challenge I just want to mention is state agencies, primarily federal agencies, because it is a federal law. Their knowledge of ANILCA is diminished by turnover. Whether you're being transferred out of the state after you've been here a while, which is kind of the routine that federal agencies go through with their employees, or you've got some long-term knowledgeable people that are retiring, you're losing institutional memory of ANILCA and the compromises that we talked about here today. And not having that voice, not speaking to those issues, not only affects the multiple state agencies' interests, but also affects the communities in our state. So that's all I have for presentation. I'm happy to answer more questions if you have more.
Well, thank you, Ms. McGee and Mr. Pollack. You know, I'm pleased to hear about the coordinated state agency reviews. At the same time, we are very saddened to lose CACFA, the Citizens Advisory Council in Federal Areas, which always kept us pretty well apprised. In fact, my staff has distributed a 2013 document from CACFA, which called out some of the important sections that both of you have very capably covered for us, but it gives it in written form. So we will be posting that on the website with today's meeting for citizens to look at, too. Committee members, any questions? Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, and for the day-to-day work that you have to do, wading through thousands of document verbs and adjectives and sentences on planning. Probably one of the things that us legislators need to continually be made aware of, just like we have to continually instruct the federal government, we have to also continually instruct where we fit in this. So the Statehood Act, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and ANILCA become our forming document for our state. The trouble is you can literally change the whole agreement for statehood based on a regulation. That's the problem. I mean, it's the tail wagging the dog in many ways. And so that's why it's so important for us to understand these. But the other part of the context is before and after, we had there was a Tongass Act already prior to this, and yet it's poorly understood how some of the guarantees were kind of meant to help us push back on some of the Tongass issues. We're there, and man, do we have a problem. But the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, NEPA all happened after this act, which have had a huge impact on how we can manage conservation units in Alaska, both federal government and how we can manage going across the land. So from your perspective, I guess, does this help us cut through them, or does this become an ineffective tool to help us navigate through these other acts that have had huge management issues in Alaska, including, I mean, the Federal Land Policy Act was predated this, but it still is overlaid in ANILCA in so many ways. So does it help us? Does ANILCA help us cut through some of these later ones, or does this just add the complexity that makes it harder to navigate?
Senator, through Madam Chair, when you're referring to the other environmental laws and regulations that are in effect today, I'm thinking primarily about the plans that affect multiple use lands as opposed to the conservation system units, And that was an issue for us in the context of the Eastern Interior Resource Management Plan that was recently finalized, because we do feel that there are existing environmental laws and regulatory authorities that protect resources that didn't exist back in the late 70s when FLIPMA was passed. And so some of these administrative designations that we're seeing, like the areas of critical environmental concern, which I believe you referenced, there's other special designations that we found in the Eastern Interior Plan that we had not seen before, riparian conservation areas. Trying to think of a few other, I'm kind of drawing a blank right now, but there's quite a few new administrative designations that were put in place with that plan. And there was no acknowledgement that there were the other regulations that would protect the resources. And so we're really looking at the justification for that designation. Are they necessary? And in a lot of instances, we don't feel that the Bureau of Land Management made a good case for needing additional special designations.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
I found it such an egregious affront to Alaska. I'm appalled still yet. But so do we appeal to Congress? Is that what we have to do? Is that something that state needs to go past the regulators? Because they, like slow-moving lava, are taking over territory that I think was never contemplated in taking over. So do you think that we need to go to Congress? Is there anything that the administration is alarmed at in this?
Senator, through Madam Chair, the state is looking at all of our options on that particular plan. Litigation being a possibility, we're just looking at these options. Part of the issue with the BLM plans right now is this new planning rule that they have recently finalized called Planning 2.0. And essentially, Planning 2.0 is seeking connectivity with ecosystems. So how that works out in Alaska is it ends up we have a lot of conservation system units already in the state, and this ends up kind of being buffers for those units. So BLM lands that are still multiple use lands are being managed primarily for resource protection under that new planning rule. So we have some concerns there, and I know Congress is looking at whether or not that rule can be repealed under the
Congressional Review Act.
Congressional Review Act. Thank you, Brad.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions for Brad or Sue? Well, thank you very much for your presentation. You know, I was looking at page 2, and you call out the 1958 Alaska Statehood Act. This is the Resources Committee, and I do feel obligated to point out, as one of the three territorial kids sitting at this table, Senator Stedman, Senator Coghill, and myself, that we became a state because of oil, the discovery in Swanson River, right? And ANCSA was actually the result of the desire to build TAPS, right? So once again, our petroleum hydrocarbon resources. Yes, Senator Stedman.
Just a point. You know, it's, I think in Southeast, we look at one of the major reasons why we wanted to become a state is to close down the fish traps. Different type of oil.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Stedman. What I wondered, Sue, is if you and Brad would be able to provide us with the list of the various provisions in ANILCA that you called out. That was really helpful, but if we could have it in written form for committee members?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, that would be great. You can just send it to my office, and I'll make sure that committee members get it, and then I'll also post it on the website for the committee. Senator Coghill.
At that point, I think one of the last acts of the Citizens Advisory Commission was to engage in an ANILCA review process. So there might be some documentation that ANILCA review, I know they contracted for some of it with some of the people who have been deeply involved in it. And since it has been a dynamic thing, I think that review shows from point A to point B the changes that you have had to deal with kind of as a matter of course. I would encourage you to kind of look around in your cabinets. There might be a pre-report ready to go. I haven't seen it yet. I'm intend to dig for it, but I know it was contracted, and I think it's a preliminary report at this point. And I think we fell short of money before we could actually produce it, I think. So, but it might be a preliminary report laying around. I think that would be interesting for the committee to see.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. And, of course, on Wednesday afternoon for our normal meeting, we'll have the Department of Law here. The Department of Law has provided me with a chart of potential conflicts, legal-type conflicts with the federal government on these kinds of issues. I'll make sure that committee members have that, and, of course, we'll be able to ask the Department of Law. They'll go through that with us. With that, thank you so much for your presentation today.
Thank you.
I want to remind committee members that on Wednesday we actually have two committee meetings. The first one is at noon, and it is our usual joint update on our mining resources, the state of mining in Alaska, and that will be in the Finance Committee room from noon to 1, and then our usual meeting time at 3:30. We'll finish up with Senate Bill 6 at that time, and then discuss federal issues with the Department of Law. So at this time, I will adjourn our meeting for today. Let the record reflect the time is 4:50 p.m.